Good morning. It's good to be with you all this morning. I'm always especially humbled to think about you. There's so many places, especially here in Alabama, that you can maybe drive within 1 hour and you can hear people singing the same songs of praise, the same people going to the same God. And we can all share this in common and have this faith that's going to be drawing us closer. And I just want to say I appreciate what you're doing here. I'm always nervous speaking at a place that I haven't done this before at, but y'all gave me reason not to be nervous. I've already talked with several of you, and you were very kind, so just want to say I'm glad to be with you all, and I hope the things I prepared this morning are going to be something that's helpful for you. We're going to be in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you want to go ahead and be opening up your Bible there, Ecclesiastes, and you want to have that bookmarked. Most of the passages I'm going to go to are going to come out of that book. So if you just want to be ready, if you see a chapter and a verse number, just assume it's Ecclesiastes. There's going to be a couple passages or a few we go to outside of that, but go ahead and have that ready because we'll be turning a lot. And the way the sermon's going to be set up, I'm going to present sort of the conclusion of it at the beginning that we need, the perspective we need to have, and then kind of go from there. So it might be a little odd in that sense, but I want to ask you, starting off with a question, would you rather gain the world or your soul? If you look in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus presented this option. And starting in verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" Now, if you just stop right there for a moment and think, gaining the whole world, that's what a lot of people think would just be the best thing ever. A lot of people aim their life to get as much as they can in the world. They think the more I can get out of it, the more of the world I can sort of acquire and have under my control, the better, the happier, the more secure I'm going to be. That's like the measure of success. How much can you gain? And they say you don't make enough money at your job, you don't have a big enough family, et cetera, et cetera. You're not very successful, or that's what we're told. But Jesus says, what if you could gain the whole world, if you could actually do that? That would be really successful, right? But then if you lost your soul, he says, "For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and will then repay every man according to his deeds." So this challenges us with the question, what is our perspective about what we're doing here in this world? What kind of mindset do we have about all the things we pursue and go after? Why are we doing it? And then in John chapter 10, another question I would ask is, would you rather have a kind of life that's going to run out and quick and you've lost everything you put your effort into and your time into, or would you rather have this persisting life, this one that keeps giving, this life that is very satisfying? It's very quenching. It gives you what you really desire. In John 10, verses 7 through 10, Jesus identifies himself as the door for sheep to enter through. And he says, "If I'm the door," in verse 9, "if anyone enters through me, he will be saved, will go in and find out. He will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." So if you really want a satisfying life, it's ultimately going to be by going through Christ. And I give that kind of introduction because if we keep these two perspectives in our mind, what are we trying to go after? Are we trying to seek out the things of the world and be satisfied and filled by that? Or are we going after the things of God and seeking those heavenly things and putting our treasure there? So we're going to be talking about life under the sun. What good things does life have to offer? That's what Solomon poses the question in Ecclesiastes, is he's digging in and thinking he has this rare opportunity as one of the richest people ever lived, that I don't have to worry about wanting to do something and not being able to afford it. He wasn't burdened that way. So he says, I can just check it out and see if I like it. And as he's going through, he makes a note of what he found was good and worthwhile to do, what seems like a good investment of your time and energy. And then ultimately what he found out was, well, this wasn't really satisfying like I thought it'd be. This didn't really complete me in the way I felt like it should. And so if you want to go ahead and look over in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, let's go ahead and turn there. I want to notice in verses 5 through 7, he said, "The sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. So thinking about the perpetual nature of the way this world works, it just sort of keeps on going. The sun doesn't ever get tired of rising and setting. It's not going to say, well, I've come up in the sky enough times, I'm not going to do it anymore. Same thing with the wind. The wind doesn't get tired of blowing. And as rivers go into the sea doesn't say, well, that's enough. And the rivers say, oh, I'm just going to stop flowing now. I've got enough of it. We've done that enough. Earth kind of keeps going. That's the way God set it up to be. However, we read that man is not the same way. We're not the same way. In verse 4, he says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. So while these things around us sort of keep going, we don't have that same kind of permanence here like the way the life around us works. You know, we might make some small little impact just for a moment, and then we're gone, and someone else is going to come replace us and do the same things we did. Also, in verse, kind of like the river that keeps on flowing, the sea never getting filled up, man is kind of the same way. In verse 8, it says, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. In other words, you're never going to get to a point in life where you feel like, I've seen enough, I'm finally am content, I don't need to see anything else new and exciting. Or you don't ever get to the point where you say, you know, I've heard enough good entertaining things, I don't need to hear anything else. And we're about to get into that more in a second. In verses 9 through 11, man repeats the same desires and pursuits of others before and after him. It says in verse 9, that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this? It is new. Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who come later still. Now, what this isn't talking about is saying, he's not saying there's never going to be an iPhone 6 one day, because there's always been an iPhone 6, and there's never going to be an iPhone 7, because that already existed ages before us. He's talking about people and the kinds of pursuits they engage in. Like, I want better communication. I want to do this more effectively. I want a more powerful weapon. I want a better way to organize my money. I want a more beautiful sight to see. I want a better kind of home to live in. All those things are things that everyone else has already done. And if anything, we're just following in the cycle of what people have done before us. And in fact, there's a lot of great accomplishments people have done in these areas that we have no idea about. We might not ever know. We talk about the ancient wonders of the world, and you know, how many of you have an idea what those are or even look like? Or the people who have made these great statues, great rulers of the past, and they really made a name for themselves, but we don't know who they are. We're really just going into the same cycle, repeating the same things other people have done, but it's going to be forgotten too, just like the things they did were forgotten. So in this lesson, I'm going to talk about three things that are vain pursuits. You know that word vanity, it comes up all the time in Ecclesiastes. And the idea of vanity, it's not just that you shouldn't do something at all or that's inherently wrong. It's just saying if you're looking for your ultimate fulfillment and getting everything you need out of something, this isn't the way to go. So we're going to go to chapter 2 now. And I'm not going to, for time's sake, I'm not going to read through all these verses, except that when we get to a point, because he's going to talk about all these things he's went after and all these things Solomon has gotten to enjoy. In verse 1, he says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. So he's going to say, I'm just going to go for things that make me feel good, and I'm just going to try to enjoy them if I can say this, to the best of the ability that I have. So one thing, in verse 4, he says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. And that's something that I think would be really nice. I know a lot of people have thought, oh, if I could just have a house like this, my life would be, and you could fill in the blank. I would have a lot of peace. It would be so nice if I could go out on this fancy balcony. Oh, if I had my little greenhouse or my little garden out back, that would be cool. Or if I live next to the river, and you could go on and on. If I just had this right kind of house to live in. Or these beautiful sites in verse 5. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I know I've thought about that. you've ever been to the nice garden before, maybe some kind of botanical garden, or maybe something even a little fancier than that, or a certain park, and you thought, wow, the sites here are just beautiful. It's so well kept. Maybe it's a certain kind of hiking trail or something along that line you've been on to. Maybe it's like the Grand Canyon, and you've been to some site like that and just thought, wow, this is amazing. He's got to do those kinds of things for himself to create those kinds of experiences. Enjoyable food and drink. He mentioned he planted vineyards for himself in verse 4, but he also mentions that he planted all kinds of fruit trees for himself. I know the idea of being self-sustaining is becoming more popular. That, you know, I can grow my own food, and I can have that. All this great food that's going to just be there for me when I need it. He got to enjoy that, to look on the labors of all of his efforts and be proud of what he's done. And then his wealth, in verse 7 through 8, he said, I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. To talk there, those slaves, those servants. How many people have thought, if I just had someone that could do this for me, clean the dishes, cook my meals, or clean my house, cut my lawn, and you could go on. If I had people just could wait on me and do things, I would have more time to enjoy to myself and be fulfilled, because I don't have to do all these meaningless things. Well, he had that kind of life. He possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded him in Jerusalem. In verse 8, I also collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. So he had wealth. I provided for myself male and female singers to say he could have his own music, but not just any music, live music when he wanted, you know, the best of the best live music at his fingertips. And then he says, in the pleasures of men, many concubines. Solomon had hundreds of wives and concubines. And I know that would sound like an appealing thing to most of the people of the world today to say, oh, I could have any woman I wanted. That was literally his state. But he could look on all that, his house, the houses he could build, the sights, the food, the drink, the wealth, the sexual pleasure. He would look on all of that. And those conclusions, he would say in verse 1, behold, it too was futility. And again in verse 11, I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. He's saying, so what did I ultimately get? What's my reward at the end of my life to say, I've done these things, so now what do I get out of it? He said, nothing. And if you're trying to strive after wind, you might imagine there's wind blowing and you try to grab some of it as it comes by, but it just slips out underneath you and you're like, well, that was worthless. Why did I even bother doing that? I put all that effort into it and I can't get it. It doesn't stay with me. He says striving after wind. And then saying there's no profit under the sun. But how many of those things do people idolize and say, if I just had that, I would be satisfied. I would be fulfilled. He's already gone under this kind of quest, and he's already told us how it turned out for him. It wasn't ultimately worth it to put his life to be focused on those things. So after we go through something that's vanity and see why he calls it vanity, I also want to offer some perspectives about how these things aren't all necessarily bad in themselves. Like, it can be okay to enjoy these things with the right perspective and in the right context. So if we turn to chapter 9, I want to make the point that it's fine to enjoy pleasure within God's boundaries. Chapter 9, verses 7 through 9, he says, go then, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already proved your works. In other words, if your relationship with God is already right, you know, you should be able to enjoy what you have. It's a gift from him. Let your clothes be white all the time. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. Notice he said woman, singular. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. So he says it's fine to be glad and rejoice in having a wife and getting to share in that relationship. That's a good thing. It's a gift from God. So there are definitely things from God that he wants us to enjoy, but understand it still needs to be in the right boundaries. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, in verses 12 through 13, he says, all things are lawful for me, not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. If we take this idea, we know there's a lot of things we can do, but it doesn't necessarily mean we should do it just because we can. And he says, food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. But God will do away with both of them. Yet the body is not for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. So just because we can eat doesn't necessarily mean every single situation we should always eat. You know, if something's wrong between us and God, maybe having a big meal is not the best time right then. Maybe we should take care of that first before we enjoy some more food. Or, he says, for immorality, just because you can engage in some kind of sexual activity doesn't mean it's always right. He says it's not for immorality, it's for the Lord. So you want to make sure that your body's going to be used to glorify the Lord. So have pleasure within the right boundary. And secondly, we don't need to let pleasure blind us from considering the end of our life. If we go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, in verses 1 through 6, I want you to consider the things he says is better to have in Ecclesiastes 7. He says, a good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool, and this too is futility. So he's saying, for one, thinking about the end of your life. If you hear about someone who's lost a loved one, he recommends you should go to that to support them, to be sorrowful for them, because in verse 2, you're going to take it to heart. You're going to think about that person as they're dead, and you're going to realize, you know, one day that's going to be me too. And it's going to put your life into a proper perspective to say, well, am I ready for that? You know, am I ready to be that person right there? Because what's going to be coming right after that? And he says, sorrow is better than laughter. To think sometimes, you know, when we're considering our life, we need to be sad about things that we're not doing right. And especially when we consider death and it brings us sorrow, it needs to humble us and make us think, I need to be right with God. And then in verse 5, it mentions the rebuke of the wise man. If someone's rebuking us saying, hey, you can be more right in your relationship with God by doing this, it's saying, I would rather hear that. I'd rather someone wise come rebuke me and make sure that my name before God is right instead of listening to the song of fools. Say, I'm just going to turn up the radio, enjoy my music a little louder. I'm not going to think about being right with God and all that Jesus stuff and following the scriptures. I just want to be entertained and soothed and enjoy good, pleasurable things. He says, don't get into that kind of mindset, because the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning. The mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Think about what's going to be more profitable for your soul. So we need to be able to consider our end. And then in chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, in verse 1, he says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come. And I'm going to skip a little bit of that for time's sake. But he talks about as people get older, that things just sort of lose their luster and maybe don't seem quite as fulfilling and satisfying as they once did. It's that the people who are all strong, they kind of start stooping down. People who are working really hard, they're not really doing that anymore. And people who are looking through windows, like their vision doesn't seem to be as good as it once was. And people who are singing all loud, they're singing a little softer now. People don't even want to go out because they're kind of more afraid of getting in some accident. And it says even a grasshopper, it can't even, you know, as springy and cheerful as they seem to be and energetic. It paints this picture in verse 5. It's just sort of dragging itself along, like it can barely make it. And it's saying that's going to be you one day if you keep getting older. So let's consider this. In verse 7, the dust will return to the earth as it was. The spirit will return to God who gave it. So think about the end of our way and consider, you know, one day I'm going to go back to the dust. My spirit's going to go back to God. And am I okay with that? Am I ready for that? So if our life is just about the pleasures of here and now, you're going to say in verse 8, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Why did I pour my effort into all that? And then especially if you do that your whole life and then you get older and you don't even enjoy life anymore as much as what you once did, to say, you know, what am I here for? That's going to happen. So he says, remember your creator now. While you have opportunity now is the time you need to be thinking about that and preparing for that. So we talked about the pursuit of pleasure, but let's also talk about prioritizing work and wealth. Look in chapter 9. This is another pursuit we need to consider. And I'm going to start off by talking about, well, there's a value in doing these things. Just because we're talking about, you know, again, that it's vanity doesn't mean it's wrong to do, doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It's just all about a perspective. Whatever your hands find to do, it says, do it with all your might, for there's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. In other words, you have one opportunity to do these things, so you might as well do it well. I think about this and reflecting on my school years when it's like, I don't want to learn all these boring facts and these dates in history, so I'm okay if I'm a B student in high school because, you know, I just didn't really care. But now I look on this and think about how that reflects on me, that kind of attitude. You don't want to be known as a person who just does things half-heartedly, who does a mediocre job at everything they do. You know, if you are going to put your mind to do something, if you have some activity given to you, you should be doing it well. It's not like you're going to be taking care of a lawn in heaven. It's not like you're going to, you know, be working at your trade in heaven and you're going to make some name and all that there and have a reputation for how well you do things. You know, if you're going to be an athlete, there's not going to be any of that. You're given this opportunity right now, so you might as well try and do it well. And also, if you look back in chapter 5, it says we should enjoy the wealth God's blessed us with. Look in verse 19 of chapter 5. He says, furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. In other words, God has given some people more riches and wealth. And it says, you know, if God gives you the ability to enjoy those things, you should understand that's God giving you a gift. And there's nothing wrong with that. But also, if we look at in verse 10, it says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with his income. This too is vanity. And it's such a striking verse to consider that you don't ever get to the point, let's say you make $1 million. Someone makes $1 million, and they're thinking, well, I don't want any more money. I finally got all I want. I read a survey recently that most millionaires don't consider themselves rich. They don't think they're quite there yet. They think around the $3 million range is when they start kind of feeling like they can do most whatever they want. But you could look at people who run those big companies, maybe some famous gas companies, that where they have a lot of money. They're not saying, well, we finally turned up enough profits. No one does that. They want to say, well, you know, what's the next step? How can we get a little more than we got last year? How can we protect what we have and keep growing? You don't ever get satisfied with getting more money. He says that's a vanity. And then in verse 11, when good things increase, let's say you do get more money, those who consume them increase. And that's a very interesting thought as well. Say you win the lottery, you might think, oh, $300 million. Wow, that's amazing. What could I do with that? Well, first, all the people that you forgot were your friends are going to show up at your door, and they're going to start asking, now, don't you remember how I was always there for you? And you know how I am right now and how hard I'm having hard times. You know, you need to be supporting me. Then all the charities are going to come knocking at your door and say, you've been blessed with this great thing. You need to be helping other people out. And all these people are going to start swarming around you. More people are going to come to consume your increase. And if you're someone who's really, really all about getting more, it's going to hurt you to see it all go. The more of it go by getting more. So he says, what is the advantage of their owner except to look on? You know, at the end of it, do you just really want to say, look at all this money I've got, and you're just sort of looking at it and then seeing it go away? It's kind of a vain thing. Then verse 12, he says, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. So you can think about maybe someone who's just flipping burgers somewhere like Jack's and be like, well, that doesn't seem like a super high successful job, but they can still get a good night's sleep and, you know, be enjoyable and content. And then you might have someone who has this, you know, Fortune, whatever, 500, I forget exactly what it's called, one of those big successful companies, and they could just be worried sick about all their investments, about how their money's being managed, you know, if it's secure, if they're going to keep growing. Some people will make themselves miserable about their money and their possessions. So he makes a little contrast. If your life is all about the pursuit of money, you know, how much pain are you really willing to go through just so you can say you have more money? Are you willing to lose sleep at night? Are you willing to work yourself sick to death? I mean, we hear about Christians who don't think it's that important to attend church because they just want to make some more money. And that should really be something that disturbs us. We shouldn't want to make our life about that. And to give some more warnings about it, there's the reality that whatever money we make, we can lose it. In verse 13, he says, "There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt." When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he fathered a son, then there's nothing to support him. So what happens when you have a lot of money, and say stock market crashes because you had a lot of money in your stocks, or maybe there's super inflation in the economy and the value of your dollar goes to nothing, and you feel like you just lost everything? It can happen. And then in verse 15, "As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die." So if you really brought nothing into this life when you came in, and then you can't take anything out with you, what was the point of getting it all if you know you're just going to have to give it up in the first place? At the end of your life, you got to give it up. So why are you toiling for the wind? And he says throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. We talked about that earlier. If you're getting really frustrated thinking, how can I get more in it? You can't even sleep at night really well as you're worried about it. It's making you sick or even angry to see when you lose a lot of money. Consider your perspective about it. In chapter 2, verse 21, he points out another evil of vanity. He says, "When there's a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with him. This too is a vanity and a great evil." I just think about in your career, you know, you build up a good name for yourself. Maybe it's some kind of mechanic company or something. And, you know, you're really known for your good business and how you have the best deals and you really take care of the problems and you're really honest. And people learn to trust that name. And then this guy has a son and the son just ruins everything. You know, he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. He doesn't care. He's a fool in how he handles it. And then the reputation of all that is just gone. It was like it was all for nothing. And you think that is so vain. That person put so much of their life and energy into it, and it's all just wasted. So, and that can happen too. So when you're thinking about the way you're building in your career and your work, you know, what are you really trying to aim for? You're trying to aim for some permanent kind of name that can just never be tarnished? Are you trying to, like, make some part of what you're doing here immortal and last forever? Just kind of realize that's not going to be able to happen. It's going to eventually be forgotten about, or it could be ruined. Don't try to make that your perspective or your big pursuit in life, your career. But we should be knowing why we're putting all this effort into what we're doing. In verse 22, he says, "What does a man get in all his labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is vanity." So if you're working really hard and you're thinking, "Man, I'm going through this every day and it's really just wearing me down," and you don't even know why you're having to go through it just to accumulate wealth, it's going to say that's a vain way to live life. And you're not going to be content with that. And you're going to be more and more fed up and say, "What's the point of what I'm doing? Why suffer just to have this stuff that I may or may not even get to use and enjoy in its fullest?" Those are the kind of questions we should be wondering about. And one question to ask, to be introspective about, is it because we have that love of money? In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 7 through 10, it says, "We have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evils, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." So this perspective of saying, it's not that I just want to be taken care of and have my food, have my clothing, and have what I need. I just want to get as much as I can. It's saying some people pursue that and they leave God because of it. They leave the faith because that's more important than what you're doing even here today. And it says it causes all kinds of grief too, unnecessary grief that they didn't have to experience, the ruin and destruction that it has to experience. So we should be careful and know while we're laboring, hopefully it's not just out of a love of money. And also, we should hope that it's not out of rivaling others. In verse 4 of Ecclesiastes 4, he says, I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. So maybe why do you take up that extra part-time job if you have a full-time job? You know, if it's for your family, that's one thing. But are you trying to have a little nicer car than your neighbors? You know, or they have something this nice. I want to at least have something that nice. You know, I don't want to look like they're better than me. Or I want to just take myself up to the next notch. I'm going to buy these nicer shoes. You know, you just want to make yourself seem like you're a little more successful than everyone else. Saying he sees a lot of people working, and it's just to be a little better than someone else. I want to rival them. I want to get the advantage. I want to look like I'm doing better than they are. I'm working harder. He's saying that's a vain pursuit. It's striving after the wind. But here's some perspectives about it that I think will be helpful for us to consider.
If I can talk, to consider. In Colossians chapter 3, Paul talks about the way we're working. And he says in verse 23, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. So instead of thinking I'm trying to please men with my work and just make everyone happy, make everyone proud of what I'm doing, should be I'm trying to please God and that he's given me these opportunities. I'm working hard at it. I'm trying to have a heavenly perspective that shows I honor him and try to do well at everything I do. That should be a perspective we have as we work. In Ephesians chapter 4, in verse 28, he says, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need. So another reason to work, instead of doing bad things with the money we have or trying to take from others, we're trying to think about, how can I help someone who really needs it? That's a good reason to be doing work and to be seeking and working hard. In Luke chapter 12, there's the parable about the man who he has so much of a good crop one land, or his land produces such a good crop one year. And then verse 17, he asks himself, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? I have so much stuff. I don't know what to do with it right now. So here's his plan, verse 18. This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Like, I finally got it made. I finally got all the stuff I need. I can just sort of retire into life and not work anymore, not think about responsibility, not think about having to serve God and all that stuff. I'm just going to sit here in my little fortified shelter of stuff and not worry about anything anymore. But then, verse 20, God says to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you've prepared? And to think about that, if you finally think you arrived with all your stuff, and then God says, well, have you arrived with me? Are you ready to meet me? Have you been laying up treasure in heaven? What about all this treasure on earth? What's going to happen to it? Who's going to own it now? It won't be that man. It says, so is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So we need the God-focused perspective in our work and thinking about why we're working. And also, we need to be content in having the Lord. We already read 1 Timothy 6, but in Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 through 13, that's where that well-known passage about Paul saying, I can be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And say, whatever lot I have, if I happen to be doing really well financially, if I happen to be really hurting financially, what's really important is that I'm focused on the Lord and he can give me what I need to keep going through my life. That's the kind of perspective we need. And then finally, in Hebrews chapter 13, in verse 5, it says, make sure your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. He's saying the reason you should be free from the love of money is because God has offered to always be with you and to be your gift, to be your reward at the end of your life. And if God's your reward, you realize you have something greater than him than you would ever find with a lot of money and with a lot of things. So we should be content in that. And again, not to say, oh, I'm not going to work anymore, I'm not going to have any more stuff. But think about why you're having it. What kind of itch are you trying to scratch there? Are you trying to do good with it? Are you trying to be mindful towards the Lord and all you're doing with it? And let's talk about one more thing. We've talked about the pursuit of pleasure, pursuit of wealth and wealth in your work. But we also need to talk about the uncertain, unfair nature of life. We talked about, it sort of makes sense. If you're looking for why you live this life, you might think, well, I want to do things that make me feel good, pleasure. Then, or you might think, well, if I have a lot of stuff, I can be really secure and happy and do whatever I want. That makes sense. But he sort of tossed both of those out the window. And then what about this one, to say, if I just try to live my life the best I can, things should just go well for me. You know, if I'm a Christian and I hit hard times, you know, people are going to be there to make sure I'm taken care of. Or, you know, if I'm living a good life, if I'm not involved in a lot of sexual immorality, I shouldn't be catching some STD. You know, I shouldn't be inflicting harm upon myself. I shouldn't be giving myself liver disease because of drunkenness. And you can go on. Maybe it's just about having a good, peaceful life here, and that's why I'm trying to do good. Just so I can avoid a lot of pitfalls of life. Just so I can enjoy this life as much as I can. But we also need to consider that there's just a lot of things that are sort of out of place that shouldn't be the way they are. And I put up that picture of a fishbowl because there's this little tiny fish in this big bowl, and there's this big old fish in this small bowl, and it just doesn't seem, you know, that's not right. Do you think that should be flipped the other way around? You think that smaller fish should be in that smaller bowl? But sometimes things just fall that way, and you wonder, why does this person get this? And this other person seems to get this really bad lot in life. And that's what he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, in verse 15. He says, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. In other words, there's just so many things that don't seem to be falling the way they should be. It's like, I can't tell you all the things I've seen that aren't right in the way this life is going. And all the things that should be there that aren't there, it's like, I can't even count them. He's talking about all the things that are messed up in this life. And look over in chapter 7. As we're going, I want to make the point, we can try to prepare ourselves for bad things that are going to happen in life, but there's no guarantee. We're all going to have to face good and bad wherever we are in our state of life. In verse 11 of chapter 7, he says, wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. So just to think about it for a second, we can try to live wise lives here on the earth, and if we have money to help us out with that, you know, that's great. It can help protect us from some pitfalls and things like that. He says wisdom, though, is going to give you what you need for your eternal life, and even it'll help you some here as well. But then he says in verse 13, consider the work of God, for he was able to straighten what he's bent. In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. Now I want you to consider that for a moment. The day of prosperity and the day of adversity. God has made both of those. In other words, God doesn't just make all of our days to go well, like getting hundreds on our tests in college and, you know, never having your boss upset at you at work or, you know, et cetera, never having your dryer or washer dryer at the most inconvenient time or air conditioning or car problem. Like, you might think, oh, if my day goes good, God is supporting me that day. If something goes bad, I just didn't get anything that day. It's actually saying here, God has also allowed you to experience bad days, and he kind of wants you to, and it says, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. God doesn't want you to think that you can just plan out every single day and it's going to go the way you want it to go, that you have it all under your control. My days are just going to be happy, happy, good, good. It's just going to keep going up. Everything's going to go well for me. In fact, he wants you to consider the work of God and say, God has made it to where you're going to have challenges and adversities, things that are going to challenge you and humble you. In fact, even though we can try and prepare for it, and we have some advantage if we try to live wisely, and we even have money to use to help us meet some of our problems. And then look in chapter 9, in verses 11 through 12. He says again, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors. Thinking about that, you think, well, who should win a race? The fastest person should win the race, right? And, well, who should win the battle? Those strong people, people who are really prepared, they've been trained for it, those should be the ones that get it. But he says that's not the case. Neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. The people you think should deserve this don't always get it. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. And you just think about talking about this adversity suddenly coming upon you that you don't expect. Like maybe this little fish that's, you know, it's swimming, it's just having a nice little day, maybe eat some worms, but suddenly it finds itself in this net and it's flopping around and it's trying to escape. It didn't plan for that to happen that day. And it's scooped out of the water and it, you know, it's going to be eaten or cooked and sold. That's the sort of what happened to his life, and it happened that way. And same thing with the bird in the net. And it's saying we're like that too. We're just going through our days. We're just trying to live a good, happy life. And then something suddenly horrible just happens to us, and you don't expect it. Saying that's what happens to us. And there's nothing you can do to be ready for those kinds of moments. I'm not talking about like having insurance and things like that. But sometimes people just lose a loved one or something, and it's just so tragic and sudden. Or someone does something evil, murders, steal, and you just can't be prepared for it. Look back in chapter 3. It says, furthermore, I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. Times where you think, this should have been the outcome of this situation. Someone was doing this evil thing, and they were rewarded for it. Or here's this righteous person, and they just got this horrible, wicked thing to happen to them, and all you can say is, why? I don't understand. And then in chapter 8, verse 11, he says, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. I mean, you ever heard anyone do some grossly horrible thing, and they're like, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. And you're thinking, well, if you just knew the judgment of God that was coming, you wouldn't be so quick to be all about doing this. And, but because they see it to be so far away, they're inclined to do these evil things because they don't think they're going to be punished for it. And you're going to see that with a lot of people and wonder or be bothered by what seems like the lack of justice, the lack of righteousness. These people should be, you know, punished for the things that they're doing, but they get away with it, so it seems. And then in verse 14, he says, there is a futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility. This is one of those more troubling verses to me. I think about this one story about this sort of younger preacher who recently got married. And I think his wife is maybe having her first or second kid, and he's gone maybe on some gospel meeting, and he comes back, and these two guys broke into the house and killed and raped his wife. You know, she was pregnant, lost her kid. And you just think, you know, this guy was doing so much work for the Lord. They're so young. They're about to have this happy family, and then these freaks just come in and do this. Like, why do you have to do, you know, couldn't that have been some horrible person that had to experience that? Why this good, righteous person? And you're going to hear tales that are just as bad, and you wonder, you know, why does so-and-so have cancer? They were doing so good. They're such a nice person. And you can fill in all the blanks. They live so righteous. Why are they experiencing this terrible thing? And then why is this evil, wicked person so blessed, getting all this good stuff? And I say this to say, if you think life is just about being good, so good things will happen to you, you're going to be really, really disappointed. Because it's not about receiving good things just in this life. And then in James chapter 4, James also talks about our perspective of what we're doing here. In verse 13, he says, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. You know, we have these plans that we're just going to do this and our life is going to prosper. Nothing bad's going to happen to us. But he says, you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and vanishes away. thinking about, you know, a pot steaming and just kind of goes up the vapor from it and you don't see anymore, saying you're like that. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. Because what's God going to give me for the day tomorrow? Don't know. I have no idea. But you can still make plans, but understand God's plan. Who can straighten what the plans he has done? Who can straighten or change his own work? We can't. We're not in that position. So we don't need to assume that we have the right and the power to drive our own lives and not have certain things happen to us. It's kind of arrogant. Because he says, but as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. It's arrogant to think we can avoid any bad things befalling on us. And God wants us to stay humble and know that certain things are outside of our control, but we need to be relying on him and seeking him. So here's some perspectives that I think will help us. Despite whatever we suffer, that we just need to be serving God. In Ecclesiastes chapter 8, in verses 12 through 13, he says, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still, I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. So even if someone that you know is so wicked and seem like they just keep prospering and things will go so well for them, he's saying, it's not going to be well for them. We can know that, but we know someone who fears God is going to be rewarded in the end. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow. The way shadow just keeps dragging on and getting longer. It's like they're not going to be like that because he does not fear God. And then in Romans chapter 8, verse 18, he says, I know that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that has to be revealed to us. Whatever you experience now, it fades in comparison to the goodness of what God has to offer in heaven, the eternal home. And then in Revelation chapter 21, there's this picture of this new city, the new Jerusalem, the new place where all God's people are. And it says in verse 4 of Revelation 21, where God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no longer any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. First things have passed away. The things of earth, all the troubles you had, are forgotten about. They just pale away. It's like they didn't happen, or they're not even worthy for you to think about anymore, because God is among you now. God's with his people. You're with him. And that would just put it, that would make everything, all the pain comforted, and that all that mourning is taken care of. It goes away. We also need to remember that God's going to rightly deal with man's action. I mean, in a way that's better than you or me could ever do. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, I'm going to be reading verses 13 and 14. It says, the conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments. Because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. So as he thinks about all these pursuits, he's like, well, the only thing that really matters is to know that you're right with God. And whatever things you undertake in your life, you want to try to do them well. You want to try to do them with a perspective that's going to be pleasing to God, instead of thinking my life's all about pleasure or my work or my wealth or just trying to get good things to happen to me, and I'm just trying to be good for this world. Don't just try to be good for this world. Try to be good because you want a good name before God, and you know one day God's going to look at all these things you've done and he's going to judge you for it, whether it's been good or evil. Finally, I want to end in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, I want to read verses 10 through 14. It says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. The same earth we talked about in Ecclesiastes that's designed us to keep on going and keep on rolling, one day God's going to put an end to that cycle and say, not anymore, it's time for it all to stop. It's time for all the activities that are here to stop, all the pursuits we go under, it's all going to go away. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, and the elements melt with intense heat? But according to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And no more of that injustice and the wickedness and the evil and those things that aren't right, that don't belong. You're going to see a place where everything is made right. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless. So though the futility of life is continually perpetuating, God's going to one day end it. So I want to ask the question, are you prepared for him to judge your deeds? I really hope as we went through these things, maybe you thought about your own perspective, had some introspection going on where you're asking yourself, you know, why do I do the things I'm doing? What's the point of what I'm doing? What am I really trying to get out of life? I really hope that as you go through this, that you're going to decide, I'm not going to try to focus on the wrong things. I'm going to try to have a perspective of seeking first the kingdom of God. I want heavenly treasure, something that's going to last. I want life eternal, not this temporary life where I invest in things and then all goes away and I have nothing. You want a heavenly life, eternal life, where you can just have abundant life and just keeps growing, becoming more wonderful instead. So are you prepared to have God meet you in peace? That's what I want to leave you with. If you want to go ahead and be opening your psalm books to the psalm invitation. Or I guess it's going to be on the screen. But if you have any kind of need, I just really want to encourage you, you know, come to your brothers and sisters in Christ. Let them encourage you in some way, whether it's pray for you, just have some encouraging words, or, you know, do you need to talk about something that's bothering you, not right between you and God? Or if you know you don't have peace between you and God because you never obeyed the gospel, and you know you want to be made right before him because God is going to judge your deeds too, why don't you take care of that as we stand and sing?